From health and wellness to education,
we need to be thinking about what it takes for students to succeed.
From art and politics to social issues of the day,
we have young Black males who are thriving in their communities and who are being shown as leaders.
The journey is what matters.
I would say to all of us, we can be better than we are.
Let's join Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, president of Howard University, and his guests as they take steps on the journey.
He has inspired others with his voice and deepened the national conversation about race, raising our consciousness with his writing. He minces no words as he works with precision and skill, pricking the conscience of the nation. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick, and my guest today on The Journey is award-winning writer, journalist, and son of Howard, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Frederick.
So the New York Observer has referred to you as the single best writer on the subject of race in the United States. As I look at the body of work, tell me a little bit about your upbringing and where you found your interest in writing.
Well, I grew up in a very literary household. My father, worked here at Moreland Spingarn Research Center. Books were extremely, extremely important. There were books all over the house. There was barely a room in which there was not some sort of bookcase. We lived in what effectively was a living library. I mean, it was just so many books around the house. And so writing almost like it just felt very, very natural to me, given how I had come up.
Now, you were born in Baltimore. Tell me a little bit about your upbringing from your birth in Baltimore.
Yeah, well, it's more the period that's, I guess, more important than anything. I was born in 1975. I grew up in Baltimore in the 80s and in the early 90s. And this is a very, very rough time in America's cities. This is the onset of crack cocaine. This is the onset of massive levels of gun violence. This is the onset of mass incarceration. It was a tough, tough, tough period. And it really, I think, to a large degree shaped the direction of my work, because one of the things I've wondered about since then is why did being Black in Baltimore, as I experienced it, feel the way it felt? And did it have to feel that way? What was behind it beyond, the obvious current trends that were there?
And what did you experience when you came on Howard campus? Describe to me what you met here at Howard.
Well, my mind was blown. I came back here a few months ago to do a talk about the book, and I sat with several groups of students. And from the first question to the last question, my mind was blown. And that was how I remember that was how it felt when I was a student. Students were so intelligent. I mean, just ridiculously, ridiculously quick. And so it was like you were, in a room. You were in, a community around folks who, were flagrantly just intelligent, could show it off. There was no stigma towards it or anything like that. My experience here was mind-blowing.
And now, in terms of some of the faculty members you would have met, because from my perspective, what really brings the academic strength to Howard University has always been its faculty.
Right.
What was the faculty like that you encountered?
Strong. I was in the history department, so I had Dr. Joseph Reedy for U.S. history, who I think has gone into the administration. I don't know if he still is.
Yes, right. He's still
in the administration. Dr. Reedy was my American history professor,
right.
And he was a tremendous teacher. Dr. Linda Haywood, who is not here anymore, she was excellent. Dr. Medford, who still is here, who I didn't have for class, but was just somebody I knew, because you were part of the department at large. Mm-hmm. It was just a stellar group.
Right.
It was just an incredible, incredible group of professors.
No, you write a lot about race and the impact of it currently in America, racism, where Black intelligentsia is or should be.
Right.
What first started you on that road?
It was here. I mean, I don't, I read a lot as a child, but I don't think I had a sense that there was a Black intellectual tradition. And so, see how it will give you the Black piece in classes that is theoretically not even Black. Mm-hmm. So I had basically when I was the freshman comp, 002 or 003, I can't remember what the number was back then. I'm sure you remember. But the readings that they would assign. Mm-hmm. So the readings you assign right off the bat, you're going to get the Black tradition right off the bat. And it slowly came to me through the classes, through a humanities class, you know, through that class, through a Black Diaspora class, through spending time in Mona Spingarn, that in fact, there was a tradition. There was a long, long thinking tradition of Black people in this country, in dialogue, in conversation, a James Baldwin, a Richard Wright. There was all these guys grappling with something. And it occurred to me then that maybe I could be a part of it. Maybe, you know, I could join in myself.
And let me ask you a little bit more about that, because James Baldwin in particular, as I read more and more of what he wrote and I try to put it in the context of the America that he met, and then you bring that forward to the contemporary experience we have in America, what is your perspective about what Baldwin's messages were?
My perspective is that he is the foremost American essayist of the 20th century. What I took from him, actually, to be honest with you, was a reinforcement of something I got at Howard University. As I mentioned before, I had, you know, these great professors at the history department. And history, when it's done right, is actually a very, very relentless social science. It gets placed into the world of soft science, but it's nothing soft about it, because over and over again, it's like, okay, where are your actual documents? Prove this. Prove it. Prove it, prove it, prove it, over and over again. And so you spend that time in archives. And one of the things that comes out of a history class is oftentimes you end up facing some sort of information that does not make you very comfortable. Mm-hmm. And you have to go write it anyway. Yes, you know, and Baldwin was just beautiful at that. I mean, he was not a very comforting writer. You know, he really, really wasn't. And he did not exist, as far as he was concerned, as a writer to make the country be more comfortable with itself. It was very, very direct. An aggressive style of writing.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Now, to switch gears from a James Baldwin, because the Howard tradition is one that's pluripotent. Mm-hmm. So when you move from a James Baldwin and you think of a Toni Morrison, mm-hmm. tell me what the juxtaposition is.
Well, for me, Toni Morrison primarily... Well, first, let me take you back to being here and to understanding that Toni Morrison had gone here, that Zora Neale Hurston had gone here, that Lucille Clifton was here, that Ossie Davis was here, that Mary Baraka was here. And so, as I mentioned earlier, not only was there a Black tradition, but, you know, Elaine Locke, I mean, Howard was essential to that Black tradition, that if you removed Howard University from that, you weren't having the same conversation. You take Toni Morrison out, you take Zora Neale Hurston out, you're not having the same conversation, not just about American literature. I mean, not just about Black literature, but about American literature, mm-hmm. period. Mm-hmm. Specifically, as a writer, Toni Morrison, as far as I was concerned, was one of the great craftswomen, maybe I can say, mm-hmm. on a sentence-by-sentence level. Just a gorgeous, beautiful, beautiful writer. I mean, just an incredibly beautiful writer. And, you know, I always thought, man, if I could write one sentence, you know, on the level of the kind of, you know, workmanship she was showing, artistry she was showing to, say, a book like Song of Solomon, I'd be all right. Only one sentence. So she was tremendous. She's tremendous.
With that in mind, you have written about reparations, mm-hmm. in particular, and I have read a lot about reparations in the past, haven't mm-hmm. been as moved, but you write it in a way that is almost pragmatic.
Yeah.
Almost lawyer-like. Tell me what
No, you're exactly right. I mean, that was
that.
What I was trying to do. I mean, I, you know, read probably quite a few of those arguments that you were unimpressed by, and I thought that they had certain weaknesses in them, you know, and I wanted to make sure in a piece that I wrote that it would address like some of the strongest criticisms. So, for instance, the criticism that there's nobody alive today who deserves reparations. And so it's very, very important to me to begin the article with somebody who was alive, who due to government policy had been robbed, who lived in a community where there were other people who were alive. You know, it's talking about the 20th century. We're not going to begin back in slavery. We're talking about the 20th century. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about housing, which is, you know, one of the great symbols of American citizenship, mm-hmm. Housing, which government policy made possible in this country, home ownership as an institution built by government policy, African-Americans excluded from it. Mm-hmm. Now, this is for most Americans, our greatest wealth building opportunity. What does it mean that for many, many years, and to some extent even today, Black folks were shut out of that? What does that mean? Does that have any sort of explanatory power to what we see in our communities? I take you back to where I began before. in my community and wondering why West Baltimore was the way it was.
Right.
And then beginning to understand that that neighborhood was, in fact, segregated. The neighbors in Baltimore were segregated, and not just segregated in the sense that we don't want white people and black people living next to each other, but we won't provide the same services. Mm-hmm. We actually won't provide them with the same sort of opportunities. And so I wanted to make people feel that case as viscerally as possible. I did not want it to be theoretical. Did not want it to exist up in the air. I wanted you to have to meet the guy who is owed reparations, who is very much alive, living on the west side of Chicago, and to look that man in the eye and say, no, you don't deserve anything.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. Now, from that, bring us to Between the World and Me.
Well, it's actually a quite a direct line. I mean, there are two things going on here. The first thing is my friend Prince Jones, who went to Howard University with me, who was killed by a Prince George's County police officer. Prince was killed in September of 2000. My son was born in August of that year. I had a one-month-old baby, and my friend had been killed by the police. And I was immediately aware that all the theoretical stuff I had read about racism was, in fact, frighteningly very, very real. And I had this serious fear for my son. And for the next 15 years, I tried to process that. And then when I went to do the case for reparations, beginning to understand that the kinds of systems that I was reporting on in that story, in fact, made a world in which Prince's death was much more likely. Mm-hmm. Seeing that connection. And I just had an urge to write in a very, very grounded, personal way about what all of that meant. And so I wanted Between the World and Me, as you said, Case for Reverence very loyally, I wanted Between the World and Me to be a little more individual, not so systemic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the society we're living in today, some people describe it as a post-racial society.
Mm-hmm.
We have an African-American president. I am the father of an 11-year-old son and 9-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They will wake up in November of mm-hmm. 2016 mm-hmm. and see someone in the White House who doesn't look like
mm-hmm.
them
mm-hmm.
for the first time
the first
in their
time.
Lives.
Yes.
What do you think? What do you think is going on in our society now as we bring all of these pieces together?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we, as a community, prepare ourselves for whatever that future?
Well, you know, I think what is true that was not true, say, 50 years ago, is if you are in this country and you are black, and you work really, really hard, and you're really, really smart, and you get lucky, you know, you have about as good a shot as anybody else at that point. And that's how a Barack Obama can be president.
Mm-hmm.
As an individual, the chances for individual black people of above average ability, you know, of above average intelligence, work ethic, and above average luck, they can get things. See, in the past, it didn't. You could have all of that and, you know, you just get stopped, period.
Right.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't exist in the same way anymore. But see, even in noting that progress, there's a problem here. And the problem is, if you are average, if you're an average black person, you will exist nowhere near the place where an average white person lives.
Right.
You just won't. You won't exist in the same world. So
yeah.
We don't have true equality. We don't have that, you know, post-racial. And I prefer a post-racist society until you can say that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the measurement of whether we live in a just society is not can somebody who is incredibly exceptional achieve it. That's not the measurement. You know,
mm-hmm.
you don't make law and policy for the incredibly exceptional. You make it for the ordinary workaday people. And until we can say those two worlds are, you know, in the same place, I don't think we're quite there yet.
As we close, what is your message about why a Howard University needs to thrive today?
If you lose Howard University, you lose the ability to produce the kind of art, the kind of politics, somebody with a different expertise, perhaps in business or something else, maybe you would say medicine, would talk about how that field would be changed. In my field, it just wouldn't look the same. I'm at the Atlantic. I could not be there. I could not have written Between the World and Me without the existence of Howard University. We as a country will be culturally poorer if we do not have places where African Americans can go to feel themselves beautiful, feel themselves too intelligent, and to have this, you know, ongoing hard conversation that allows them to, you know, go out in the world and, you know, rumble with the best of us, you know?
Yeah.
Beauty is not free. As beautiful as this place is, it charges you with something. You are then responsible to it. There's a pact, you know, there's an agreement that you have to support the place that made you who you are.
Right. Thanks for being here. My guest today has been Ta-Nehisi Coates, a true son of Howard University. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, right here on the Howard University Radio Network.